Kathy Magliotto is a heart surgeon, and to let you understand how unusual that is, let's look at the numbers. Since it was established in 1948, the American Board of Thoracic Surgery has certified 7,400 heart surgeons. Only 180 of them have been women. Dr. Magliotto's specialty is even more unusual. She is one of the few surgeons trained to do heart transplants. Her memoir, Healing Hearts, tells the story of how she broke through the glass ceiling while juggling a husband and family along with her career. The book is published by Broadway Books. I'm very pleased that it has brought it to our show today. Hi.
Hi. Thanks, Leonard.
After reading about your typical day, I feel guilty taking you away from your family and your patients for even a half hour. When did you find the time to write this book?
Well, that's a wonderful question. You know, right now, by the way, speaking of being away from my family, my just so you know, don't feel guilty because my two children, who are 4 and 6, are just enjoying the snow sledding in upstate New York with my mom and dad. So not to worry. But writing the book really, to say the least, was a challenge. I honestly wrote the book between 4 a.m. and 6 a.m., and then I would write again after the kids got to bed, so say, you know, somewhere between 9 and midnight, and then I took off on weekends and did it.
Well, it's really well written, so I wonder whether you had thoughts at a certain point of becoming a writer instead of becoming a doctor. How did you wind up becoming a doctor?
Oh, my goodness. I don't think I would ever give up being a physician. You know, writing the book, no pun intended, came from my heart. And writing it was almost easy, Leonard, because I just, the words just flowed out of me onto the pages. And at one point, my publishing agent, at one point we sort of entertained using a ghostwriter. And once he read some of the things I wrote, he said to me, "You have to write this book because it's so close to the bone. It has to come from you."
Well, when you decided to become a doctor, did you originally imagine yourself in the more traditionally female specialties, OBGYN, pediatrics, dermatology?
Yeah, good question. Well, you know, no, I think if I had a dime for every time someone told me to go into those specialties, you know, I would probably have done it. But it seemed like the more people told me that I couldn't do it, that being a female heart surgeon was an unattainable goal, the more I wanted it. And so I really was drawn to heart surgery. I was drawn to surgery in general. And so for me, it was very, very clear from the early part of my medical training that I really wanted to be a surgeon.
Well, there was a moment where that was determined,
yes.
A moment that might have driven other people into another specialty.
Exactly. That was the first time I touched the human heart, and that's actually the opening chapter of the book called Love at First Touch. And it was when I was an intern in general surgery, and I was staring at the OR board in the morning. I was exhausted, and I was just looking at the OR board to see what my day was going to be like. And someone grabbed me and said, "Oh, my God, Dr. Netter needs you in OR 7 stat," and grabbed me and literally threw me into an operating room where a heart surgeon was trying to sew a hole shut in the heart to save the life of a patient. And he had me glove up and hold the heart because, you know, I know your viewers can't see, but you can see that my hands are these huge mitts. They're not these little delicate things that you'd expect from a heart surgeon. And so I was able to kind of palm that heart just so for him to be able to put the stitches in and save that patient's
life.
And
that was the turning point?
That was it for me. That was it. I said to him, I said, "Wait a minute, do you get to do this every day?" And he said, "Well, of course I do. I'm a heart surgeon." That was it for me, Leonard.
Is there a reason that women don't usually select heart surgery?
I think it's because it is incredibly demanding. First thing is it's a long haul. It's a long road. I trained for, you know, 9 years after medical school to be a heart surgeon.
Oh, wow.
So it's
so you have to postpone motherhood and all sorts of other things.
Yes, both of my children, I had them both after the age of 40, which is a little tricky in and of itself, Leonard. But the other part of it is lifestyle. I mean, I am basically on call 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and I think most women feel they can't have a family. They can't have a husband and maintain that lifestyle. And I'm hopefully my book will reach out to women to say, yes, you can have it all.
Can I assume that this is also a boys' club that women are discouraged from entering?
You know, I don't know that we're discouraged from entering. I think a lot of it is we just don't have a lot of mentors, and that's the problem. I really had no female mentors going through it, and that would have been wonderful to have that.
So you must have been aware that there are very few women working in the field
Yes.
from the start.
Yeah, from the start.
Where did you grow up?
Oh, I grew up in a farm in upstate New York. I live on a 50-acre apple farm in a little town called Highland, New York, in the Hudson Valley area. Quite beautiful.
Any doctors in the family?
No. You know, in fact, I think a lot of the questions I get is, oh, your mother and father must be a physician, or you must have a physician in the family. And I'm really proud to say that my mom and dad aren't physicians and that I don't have a doctor in the family. And I think that wanting to be a physician really came from me. I was in medical school with a lot of students who went into medicine because their mom or dad was a doctor, and my inclination really just came from within.
And most people who go into medical school were top students. You say you weren't a particularly good student either.
No, I think I was. I was a good student. I was. I think I had that type A sort of gunner personality that you see in medical school. But I had to work very, very hard because I came from a system in school where I didn't have a lot of the advanced credits and advanced placement. And for me, going to college, I went to Union College in New York, and that opened a vista of learning for me that really enabled me to attain anything I wanted.
Well, you reveal a dark secret in your book. And I hope that you're serious about what a relief it is to get that out, because I'm going to ask you about it now. Why did you fail to get into medical school the first time you applied?
Goodness, I knew you were going to ask that question. That is one of my few dark secrets that I tell in the book. That was one of the most difficult things, Leonard, to write. It was hard for me to admit that I didn't get in the first time around. And yet,
is that typical?
You know, medical school at that time was so competitive that wasn't atypical. But for me, my grades were just not as solid. I really struggled my first 2 years of college. I think I really just had to learn how to be a better student, and Union taught me that. But then as I became a better student, my grades improved, and then I was able to get in. But admitting that, I think, is key, because I think it sends a message to people that, listen, there are lots of roadblocks in life to achieve your goals, but you got to somehow get around that. You just have to if you want to be who you want to be when you grow up.
Was med school easier for you than regular college?
No, med school was quite difficult because, again, getting into med school, that was like the cream of the crop, top-notch students. And so, yeah, there were a lot of gunners. They graded us on a curve, so you were actually competing against every other medical student.
It's interesting you've used that word gunner a couple
of
times.
Yeah, sorry.
And you say that your general surgery training made you build a full metal jacket. A lot of military metaphors here.
Now I'm trying to save lives, not take lives, Leonard. Funny you should say that. No, the full metal jacket metaphor was something that, for me, it was so grueling and difficult and emotionally challenging, watching patients die every day from heart disease, whether that was an elderly patient, or in one chapter in particular where I saw a baby die. I mean, I had to build some type of protective barrier to kind of make it through my residency. And then to me, the most beautiful thing I ever did was to take that jacket off and become connected again to my patients.
What's an ER thoracotomy, and why did your male colleagues think that you would chicken out from doing it?
An ER thoracotomy is when a patient sustains basically a lethal, either a blunt trauma to the chest, or more commonly a sharp trauma to the chest, like a gunshot wound or a stab wound to the chest.
And they show up at the emergency room.
They show up dead on arrival to the ER. Oftentimes, we literally have to open their chest immediately, right there on the gurney, reach in, grab the heart, and start open cardiac massage. And it takes a lot of fortitude to do that. You have to really be able to make quick decisions. And, I mean, Leonard, can you imagine taking a knife and just cutting a chest open? That's what it's like.
I cannot.
In fact, you cannot.
No, well, I think that it's what separates the surgeons from the rest of us. Yeah. You cut open flesh. Atul Gawande wrote about that experience in something that I found very moving in The New Yorker. But it's the blood, it's all the other stuff that most of us have a hard time with. And you say that you couldn't have participated in an arm amputation without your defenses.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. In that chapter, which is called Detached, it's all about, you know, physicians being detached from their patients. And at times, that arm amputation, I was or had to be detached. And that was really, for me, the last time I ever did that. Because I think it's really important, especially as a surgeon, that you be emotionally connected to your patients and not distance yourselves.
So you don't do arm amputations. No. You just do open heart surgery and heart transplants.
Yeah. Well, I'm not currently doing transplants now at my current hospital because we're not a transplant facility. But I'm doing all of types of adult cardiac surgery.
When you applied to cardiothoracic training programs, there were very few women applying. What kinds of reactions did you get?
Well, I remember one funny story I'll tell you is when I sat across from one of my interviewers who said to me, "Now, listen, Kathy, if you start training as a cardiac surgeon, what are you going to do if you get pregnant?" And I thought about it for about 30 seconds and said, "Well, I guess I'd stand farther from the table."
and you take a little time off to have the baby.
That was the end of that interview.
Well, but you talk about all sorts of things in here where men seem to be a lot more insensitive than we would like to think our doctors are.
Well, you know, I hate to do that. I know a lot of male doctors who are just wonderful, and I don't think being a sensitive doctor is gender specific. I think it has to do, and I always tell people that I think that the two things that make you a good doctor is, first, the person you are to begin with. You know, doesn't matter male or female. And second is the level of training you've had.
So when you became pregnant, did you stand further from the table?
A lot further from the table. In fact, I pretty much operated full bore until I started getting contractions when I went in helicopters to retrieve organs for donors for heart transplants. And then I had to stop operating for a while. But about 6 weeks after I delivered, I went back operating again.
Well, you could have gone back to the amputations. All you had to do was hold the arm out as it was cut.
So
you could have stood far away from the table.
Right.
My guest is Kathy E. Magliotto, who's written a memoir called Healing Hearts, a memoir of a female heart surgeon. It is published by Broadway Books. We will continue our conversation after this. We're back with Kathy E. Magliotto. In Italian, it would be Magliotto. Her memoir, Healing Hearts, is published by Broadway Books. And you told me that it wasn't your intention to write a memoir at first.
Right. My intention was to educate women about heart disease because, as you probably know, Leonard, heart disease is the number one killer of women. It's killed more women than men every year since 1984. It's an epidemic, but nobody knows this. So originally I started out by wanting to write a book that will educate women about heart disease. And yet, you know, what woman is going to wake up one morning and say, "Oh, I want to go out and buy a book about heart disease in women?" So I thought I would make it more interesting by telling actual, very tragic, very poignant stories about women who have died from heart disease. And then I met this terrific publishing agent who said, "Listen, Kathy, I want you to tell the story about heart disease in women, and I want you to tell your patients' stories." He said, "But I want to know your story. I want you to tell your story." And that's how it morphed into a memoir, which I think makes it more interesting and educational for women.
After you got into a program, you shared an on-call room and bathroom with three male residents. This is one of the other problems when you are in such a minority in a field.
Right. Well, that was a piece of cake, Leonard. I have
that wasn't awkward at all?
No, I have three younger brothers and one bathroom in our house in Highland, New York. So for me, that was pretty easy. We just, you know, fought over covers and we fought over shower time. But for the most part, it worked.
Do you think that there are some ways that women are better doctors? I mean, we always think of women as being more empathetic. And yet you talk about that full metal jacket and I'm assuming that means at times you find it or found it harder to get close to people.
I don't know that I would say a blanketed statement that women are better doctors in general because of their gender. But I will tell you personally that as a woman, I had to work twice as hard to get half the credit. And that made me a better doctor. I had to try that much harder and be that much better. And I think that there were some women that I did meet in medicine that had a chip on their shoulder about that. And instead, I chose to turn that around to a positive and make myself a better doctor because of it.
You mentioned going on donor runs. What does that entail?
A donor run is a donor procurement. So when we get the call that there's a donor who has so beautifully given this gift of a heart transplant, the transplant team where the recipient is located, that hospital, we would then go to the donor hospital and take out the heart from that donor and bring it back.
So actually a heart transplant involves two operations.
Exactly. Exactly.
We always think of just the one in which it's attached. But if it isn't detached, absolutely right, the whole problem, I mean, it could cause a lot of problems.
Well, it'd be nice if the organs would just sort of drop, like from a stork, just drop out of the sky. But they don't. And it's actually very critical that the recipient hospital team go and get the organs, because we can evaluate that heart, make sure it's suitable for the recipient, and only we know the recipient. The sad story about organ donation and heart transplantation is that on the list right now, we have about 4,000 plus people waiting for a heart transplant, and yet we only get about 2,000, 2,300 usable organs per year. So making that judgment call as to whether that heart is usable or not is really key.
Was that first donor run a success?
Yes, it was. It was when I was at the University of Pittsburgh, and it was a baby. It was that was really rough. It was a baby who was just a few days old, and what a beautiful heart. It was like just the size of like a quarter or half dollar. And I remember for a brief moment I got to hold it in my hand when I took it out, and then the surgeon that I was with said, no, put it down, because my body heat was warming the heart, and that's detrimental to a heart donor. So I only got that brief moment, but it was so beautiful.
If it's that small, is it more difficult to put it into the baby's chest?
Yes, it's just a much finer, more meticulous surgery. I have such respect for pediatric cardiothoracic surgeons, because they're really the upper echelon of skill sets for cardiac surgeons.
Well, people still have to take anti-rejection drugs, medications, if they have a heart transplant. How do you do that with a baby?
Right. Well, they have to take lifelong immunosuppression or anti-rejection drugs, as you call them. And the balance is that you have to take enough drug so you don't reject, and then balance that against too much drug, which then can set you up for infection. So you're constantly in that balance between rejection and infection. You can die from either one of those things. So.
Now, I've asked you more than once about sexism. You've kind of like skirted the issue. But I know, having worked at times in fields where pretty much everybody was all male, or sometimes where I was the only male, that there are cultures that you have to deal with. I don't know what it was like for you as a woman doctor with nurses who are used to taking orders from men, and there's that whole hierarchy. But also, I just would assume that there were doctors who patted you on the behind and did all sorts of things that we would consider inappropriate in other circumstances.
Yeah, I think the line I put in the book is that to tell everyone that sexism is alive and well in medicine. And if you ask any woman doctor, it's kind of our dirty little secret. I think that goes on in all professions. But that was particularly difficult for me. I wrote a chapter called Sex and the Surgeon, which is all about that. And I remember my husband read the chapter and he said, boy, this is a rough chapter, because it was, you know, kind of a tell-all about some of the sexism that I had to endure.
Does it change when you have a solid record behind you?
You know, I wish that it would. I still think that people look at me and don't, not in the sense of sexism, but they look at me and they say, oh, are you my nurse, or you can't possibly be my surgeon, or, you know, that sort of stereotypical role of being a male still exists. Now, that's not necessarily.
And would they
sexism.
Be more nervous because you are the woman who is going to be doing this operation on their heart?
You know, not necessarily. I had one patient who thought it was terrific that I was a woman, because he said, you know what, I'm kind of glad you're a woman heart surgeon, because I bet you had to work harder than everybody else to be who you are, and that's the surgeon that I want.
Well, you say that your nickname during your residency was Ice.
Yeah, that was during my residency as a heart surgeon, because, yeah.
But then you actually caught fire in the operating room?
Yeah, that's the chapter's Fire and Ice, and it talks a little bit about that, you know, in order to be a heart surgeon, you really have to maintain focus and control, and so you have to be ice in the operating room. The fire part of that story was when I was an attending surgeon, and a spark caught the patient and myself on fire in the operating room, and I had to very calmly, very smoothly put the patient out and then put myself out, because, again, losing control in the operating room can result in a patient dying.
Well, didn't anyone else realize that there are a whole bunch of people around you? They could have just patted the fire out while you were doing what you were doing.
Well, the problem was the fire was locally right where I was operating, because the electrocautery I was using caused the spark. And because the flame was burning clean, you couldn't actually see the flames. I actually couldn't see the flames. I could just feel the heat of it, because it was a high level, I think it was a 94% alcohol solution that was burning.
And you still have a scar from that.
I still have a little scar on my thumb from that, yeah.
I'm sure most people who watch the TV shows wonder how realistic they are. How realistic is a TV show like Grey's Anatomy?
Well, I can tell you, Leonard, and I'm not sleeping with everyone I work with, just so you know. And I think my husband's probably happy that I reassure him about that. I think for the most part, a lot of the medical drama is realistic. I mean, I will tell you that I just came off a really horrific week. Back in California, I came out here on Saturday, and the week before, we had three cardiac arrests that week alone. One of the patients I was able to save and is doing well, and one of the patients died right there on the cardiac catheterization table. So that life and death drama you see, I think is pretty real. However, it's the sort of sideline stuff that may or may not necessarily, at least for me, it's not real.
But I would assume that since you're working in this very closed environment with a small group of people, the only people who can understand the kinds of pressures that you're living with day by day, I don't mean you in particular, but that sort of thing would be fairly common.
But don't you think it's perhaps common in other workplaces as well? I mean, I think that goes on everywhere.
It never happens, and in fact, it never happens in politics.
Oh, right, exactly, especially here in New York, exactly. But I will say that marrying a liver transplant surgeon was a good thing because my husband, he gets me and he understands my day, and I can't imagine being married to someone outside the profession.
So he does liver transplants, you do heart transplants?
Right. And then we argue over which is the more important organ. And I keep telling him, look, if you can buy the organ in a store, it can't be that important, right?
If you get your kid doing kidneys.
Oh, then we have the trifecta there. That'd be great.
How do you manage a courtship in the time allotted to you during training?
Well, I think for my husband and I now, I think our marriage is so solid because we don't spend, you know, every waking moment together. We have a really nice tradition of getting up at the crack of dawn, like 4:30, 5 o'clock in the morning, and sharing a pot of coffee before our day begins and kind of getting caught up. But, you know, I think it's important in a relationship to make that kind of time. And I do that not just with my husband, but balancing my children as well. And I think for me, it's about living in the moment. So when I'm at the hospital, I'm in that moment. And when I'm at home with my children, I'm living in that moment. And then the question is trying to live moment to moment.
Just one more thing. You said that you originally planned to do something about heart disease for women, but aren't men more vulnerable to heart disease than women?
No, actually, as I was saying, more women have died from heart disease every year since 1984. And when women
get... Is that because women smoke more now?
No, a lot of it is because heart disease is underdiagnosed in women, and it's because women don't understand their symptoms, and women are so busy worrying about breast cancer, they kind of forget what's killing them, and that is their heart.
Kathy E. Magliotto is currently the Director of Women's Cardiac Services at St. John's Health Center in Santa Monica, California, and attending cardiothoracic surgeon at Torrance Medical Center in Torrance, California. Thank you so much.
Thank you.